Good evening, everybody. This is Patrick from the Poison Pen Bookstore here in Scottsdale, Arizona. And we're here with another of our virtual events this evening. And today we have our good friend, Stephen Mack Jones, who has a really kick-ass new book called Dead of Winter out. We still have some autographed copies. Steve was kind enough to sign some for us. So I'll put a link in the comments field if you're interested in ordering one of them. And they are going fast, I must say. And also joining us this evening is our good friend, Ellen Crosby, who's agreed to come in and do the heavy lifting on the interview. And her latest book is, I believe, called The French Paradox, right? Which came out in April. And so thanks so much for agreeing to do this. I understand you guys are friends, so
yes.
This should be great. And Barbara is at her home office there. And so we're all over the place, spread out in the technology allows us to do that these days. But I'm going to be monitoring the comments field on Facebook. So if you have questions for Stephen or Ellen, go ahead and put them in and I'll appear towards the end of the program and we'll ask some of your questions. So Barbara, over to you for now.
Thank you. Isn't Zoom a miracle? I mean, we have Stephen in Detroit and Ellen in Virginia and Patrick down at the Poison Pen and me home here in Scottsdale, and we're all together. So I've been asked how we see the future of the bookstore once live events and so forth can happen. And my answer is we're gonna do live events, but we're gonna keep these two because it does allow us to marry up things that we would not be able to do in the ordinary course of events. So our focus tonight is on Stephen Mack Jones, whom I'm happy to say has been visited at the been to visit us at the Poison Pen and introduce us to his spectacular character, August Snow. Wow, what a creation. So Stephen is a published poet and a playwright. He's won a Kresge Arts in Detroit Literary Fellowship and the Hammett Prize, which is really an amazing award given by a kind of international group of judges. And is, I think, one of the most prestigious of all awards for that very reason. So joining us, Ellen Crosby is a longtime friend. We've hung out in all kinds of places, including the Desert Botanical Gardens, but sadly, never in a Virginia vineyard. Rats.
No, we'll have to remedy that.
No, but I first got to know Ellen's work when she wrote about her time as an investigative journalist with a book called, was it Moscow Rules?
Moscow Nights. Moscow Nights.
Okay. And I've really loved her Virginia Wine Country mysteries, of which the most recent is?
The French Paradox.
Thank you. Which we don't have any copies of because we sold all of our autographed copies and we have to order some more. And it's been a wonderful series to read and fun for wine lovers, but also threaded through with lots of history and wonderful facts around Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C., some political, some arts community. It's been great. Anyway, to my great surprise, I discovered that Ellen and Stephen, how would I know this? We're friends. And you interviewed Stephen, what, at the Virginia Literary?
At the Virginia Book Festival in 2019, yeah. Which was the last live book festival. And then I discovered both of us were back for the virtual festival, Steve. Didn't you interview S.A. Cosby and Walter Mosley, right?
Exactly, yeah.
And I interviewed Kara Black. And then a few days later, I was with you, Barbara, right before you interviewed Kara Black. So it's this whole sort of serendipity thing. But anyway, it all sort of revolves around the Virginia Book Festival.
So, right. So yeah. with that fabulous background, I'm just going to sit back, drink my wine, which I'm going to raise in a toast to Stephen. This is a BYO event, BYOB, right?
I brought tea.
But anyway, Stephen, such a pleasure to see you. Thank you very much for making
it's
time.
It's wonderful to see you, Barbara.
And Ellen is going to lead us in a fabulous, scintillating, penetrating, and insightful discussion.
We're going to talk really fast because I have so many questions. So it's going to be just really fast. And I already told you this.
I'm going to stop you right there and say that it is such an honor to be with you, Ellen. You are wonderful. I love your writing. I honestly do. This is the last book. I've got to get the new book. But I'm just thrilled to be here with you. And of course, Barbara.
Yeah. I was so pleased when Barbara asked me to interview you. So this is definitely a mutual admiration society. So I sent you some questions this morning because we talked on the phone yesterday, we chatted, and we are prepared. But I have like 3 pages of questions and we're never going to get to all of them. So let me just dive right in. First of all, you have 3 books about August Snow, and Dead of Winter is the newest one. I've read them all. I love them all. So I want you to talk a little bit about August Snow first. I want you to talk about who he is, who and what he loves, what he believes in, and why you created him. And I found this description of him that I love from Deadline. They called him a Robin Hood from the hood. And I think that's like a perfect description. So tell how he got his name, but talk about August.
Well, to tell you about how he got his name is really a boring story. I hate to start that
way. Cool story, though.
The thing of it is, I wish I could tell you in professorial English 400 graduate student terms how the name came about, but honestly, the name came about while I was mowing the lawn in the backyard.
Yeah.
And, mowing the lawn is just, zen with a power tool. And, while I was mowing the lawn, two words settled on my mind, August and snow, and I laughed them off. It doesn't snow in August. What's wrong with you? Well, the truth of the matter is those words stuck like thistles in my brain for like 2 weeks. And I thought after 2 weeks, I'm going to have to do something about this. And the first choice is I'm going to have to seek talk therapy, to find out what's going on. And the second choice was to write a story with that as the name. And since, as we all know, writing stories is a cheaper version of therapy, without the copay, I had a 3-page treatment of a story, which eventually turned into August Snow. But in the treatment, I had hero in cap letters does this, hero goes there. And I thought, oh my goodness, how about the name August Snow?
It's a great name.
Yeah, and that's how it came about, throwing in, of course, his middle name, Octavio, which was one of my favorite poets.
Right.
Mexican poet Octavio Paz.
Right.
That was the genesis of August Snow.
But August Snow is biracial. So how did, talk a little bit about his background.
August is half African-American, half Mexican-American. And in Detroit, the two largest minority groups are African-American and Mexican-American.
Right.
And as you may very well know, these two minority groups from New York to Chicago to Detroit, LA, have not often gotten along.
Right.
They're butting heads.
Yeah.
And I wanted to create a character who was just absolutely in love with both cultures.
And his parents.
And his parents play a large part in his life. His parents are deceased, but they are the ones, his Mexican-American mother and African-American father, who was a cop, and his mother was an artist. He learned to appreciate the best from them in both cultures, music, food, et cetera, and so forth.
Yeah, he's a great character. He really is. Can you talk, and like I said, I have so many other questions to ask you, but can you tell a little bit about the plot for Dead of Winter? And then I want to talk to you about Detroit next.
Yes,
tell a little bit about the plot.
Dead of Winter finds August in front of a very elderly gentleman who owns a business in Mexicantown, Mr. Ochoa.
Which is the part of Detroit where the book takes place, by the way.
Yes, yes. Right. Mexicantown is considered Southwest Detroit.
Okay.
And historically, Mexican Americans have lived in Southwest Detroit for nearly 100 years. Mm-hmm. It's been a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And many of them came for the same reason that African Americans came to the North in the 30s, the 20s, 30s, 40s. And that is because of the work that was offered in the automotive plants.
Right.
It was out of the fields, whether picking cotton or picking tomatoes, what have you. And it was good, steady work for a good, steady wage. August is a product of those two cultures. Mm-hmm. And he is a former Marine. Mm-hmm. Having, you know, fought in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. As a sniper. And he is a ex-Detroit cop. And ex-Detroit cop because he was kicked off of the force because he started investigating malfeasance in the mayor's office.
Which is the backstory.
Who ever heard of that in Detroit?
That's the backstory.
Right,
yeah. Right. So he becomes this Robin Hood of the hood. And by the third book, he got some money from this court settlement and he's now a multimillionaire. And he's doing so much good with it. So he ends up at this place, this tortilla factory, where this gentleman wants him to buy it because he is a multimillionaire. So go a little bit more into the plot of Dead of Winter.
Well, Mr. Ochoa wants August to buy his Mexican food production facility, not because he necessarily likes August. Mr. Ochoa knew his mother, knew that his mother worked at the factory for years while August was in school, but primarily because Mr. Ochoa and the business have gotten a rather curious offer from some people who prefer to remain anonymous.
Some shady guys. Right.
And Mr. Ochoa, who is dying, would prefer that it go to somebody from the neighborhood instead of this being pressured by this unknown entity. Mm-hmm. And August really doesn't see himself as a tortilla king. His concern is that he has a hard time running his own household, never mind a business that employs 60 people from, you know, Mexicantown, which is essentially one square mile of Detroit.
Right.
So unfortunately, Mr. Ochoa ends up dead. It would have been a lot easier to wait 2-3 weeks because that is all Mr. Ochoa had with cancer. Unfortunately, he is shot to death. And August, never one to leave a dirty stone unturned in Mexicantown, begins to investigate that death and uncovers a, how shall I say, a gentrification scheme that is beyond anything anyone ever imagined.
Right. So I really love your story. You have such great characters, such a great cast of characters. And before we get into some of them, I don't want to pass over the fact that to me, the biggest character is the city of Detroit. You love Detroit. I don't particularly think Detroit has this whole lovable thing going on with it. You know, there's kind of some issues, maybe a little crime, a little corruption, some poverty, but you love Detroit. And so there was, so one of my favorite quotes, and it's on your book, in fact, on your book jacket, is Nancy Pearl, who reviewed it for Morning Edition. And she said, this was the first book, "This book is so good, I actually put it down and I briefly entertained the notion of moving back to Detroit." And that is, you know, that's quite, that to me is like the ultimate compliment. So, and Detroit is just woven through the book. What's your love affair with Detroit? What did you, and are you selling us Detroit, or what's all that about?
Well, I've lived in Detroit, Detroit proper, Detroit suburban, for over 40 years, which to some is a long time. To others, I'm a newbie.
Really?
Oh, you've only been here for 40 years?
Wow.
Oh, well then, let me tell you about, et cetera, and so forth.
Wow.
And that's wonderful.
Yeah.
But Detroit is so much more than the stereotyped shorthand that we see in the news media, or in TV or movies that may reference Detroit.
Right.
Detroit is a very diverse city with African American, Mexican American, East Indian American, Vietnamese, Chinese, Japanese. It is an extraordinarily diverse city.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go from culture to culture in both language and food and experience.
And you do that really well in the books. You really do. I mean, I've never been, but I do want to go, you know, because of your, it's just a love letter. It really is, I think.
Well, you know,
all three books.
I think of Mexicantown, and I have in the first two books essentially expressed my love for Mexican restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
The food is tremendous.
Plus Mexican cooking.
I'm sorry?
Plus Mexican cooking.
Yes, absolutely. The varieties of Mexican cooking from various regions of Mexico.
Do you know this personally, or how do you know all this? Is this part of your background?
Well, you know, I am not going to stand up because it will show how much pandemic weight I've put on.
Oh, that's okay.
That can be from directly attributed to Mexican food.
Oh.
Okay. But in Mexicantown, there's also, and I mentioned this restaurant in the book, Flowers of Vietnam.
Right.
Which is an extraordinary Vietnamese restaurant. The food is incredible. And if that's not enough for you, pay your bill at Flowers of Vietnam, and then take a short 15-step walk to the Hawaiian Tiki Bar next door.
Wow.
Who would have expected this.
Yeah.
Well, it is wonderful, but you know, I have relatives who went to Detroit specifically to see some of the architecture because due to its financial problems, some of Detroit, you know, was abandoned or bankrupted or disintegrated, which has really cleared the way. Very similar, I think, to the way the East End of London or the city of Hamburg in Germany were basically blown apart by World War II. And so they've gotten to completely rebuild them. So there's a lot of exciting things going on in Detroit as a consequence, really, of the financial disasters that have overtaken it. So it's a city in the process, I think, of rebooting and reimagining itself and doing some very interesting things. And there still is a lot of money there. It's not scattered across all the population, but there's still some real old money in Detroit.
Well, let me give you one example of Detroit's reemergence. We're all familiar with Detroit having gone through bankruptcy.
Right.
And very few other cities, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, very few of those cities, municipalities, found themselves laughing. None of them laughed because they all had the same bonds.
Yeah.
They were looking at Detroit to see what happened there as a cautionary tale. Right. Well, one of the things that happened was there was, by the bankruptcy attorneys, they started looking at the Detroit Institute of Arts. Mm-hmm. Well, there might be $2.5 billion in art there.
Mm-hmm.
Not on display, but being restored, et cetera, and so forth.
Right.
And the Detroit Institute of Arts did something that had never been done in the United States before. And that is, they told every county surrounding Detroit, hey, listen, folks, you're a member now. You don't have to pay to come in. You're a member.
Wow.
All you have to do is approve this millage that is showing up in your county. And that millage essentially pays for your membership.
Wow.
And the only thing you have to pay for is special exhibits, whether it's Degas or automotive design through the years or Star Trek. That's the only thing that you have to pay for, and it's a nominal cost.
Wow.
And that was so innovative that the New York Times covered that.
Mm-hmm.
So I say that to say, yes, Detroit was in bankruptcy. Yes, Detroit found a way out, and a lucrative way out, a creative way out. And it's attracting more artists, more businesses than it ever has.
Wow. Well, talking a little bit about some of that and getting back a little bit to the pandemic stuff, talking about all this creative stuff, you have a TV series coming up, right? So I just to get a little bit back into that, and then I still have other questions for you, but I'm looking at our time. So back in January, I saw that you have a television series in the works, and Keegan-Michael Key is interested in the August Snow PI drama series. It's currently in development, as we talked about, at ABC and Imagine TV Studios, which is Ron Howard Studios. Right. So you kind of landed in a pretty good place. So that sounds like a really big party. So talking about one's love affair with Detroit, you have a story about Keegan-Michael Key that has to do with you being a playwright. And talk a little bit about this whole television thing and, like, you know, are you ready to dash off to Hollywood? Are you writing already? Have you got your ducks for the Oscars or the Emmys or whatever? So what's up?
First of all, I have to thank Keegan-Michael Key, because he is the son of Detroit.
Yes.
He was raised in a suburb of Detroit, Southfield. He went to University of Detroit, Jesuit, and he still has artistic interests in Detroit. So I am-
His father is a Catholic, and you bring some of that makes its way in there too. So there's that whole, yeah, okay.
The Padre Espiritu Santo.
Right,
yeah. August will be played by Keegan-Michael Key, who is also an executive producer. It also includes, as you mentioned, ABC TV,
Ron Howard,
Imagine Studios, Ron Howard, and Gaspin Media, who have several shows on now. You might be interested to know that I am an executive producer.
Well done, you. Well done.
Huh?
What is
How about that?
Yeah. Okay. I'm impressed.
And
we're both impressed.
And my duties include making the, 12 o'clock noon run to Starbucks.
Oh, good. Okay.
I'm proud of that.
Yeah.
But
go to Hollywood.
I may very well go there on a visit, a consulting visit, should everything work out.
Yeah.
But honestly, Ellen, I'm a child of the Midwest.
Right.
And some may see that as pathetic, but I find it a mark of pride.
There you go.
It's the writer on the project is Paul Eckstein.
Okay, that's right. I read that. Yeah.
Right, and Paul is phenomenal.
Good. Oh, that's great.
On Order, really? Criminal Intent.
Oh, wow.
Narcos, the first season, and The Godfather of Harlem on Epic, which is in the second season. So,
what's your Keegan-Michael Key story that has to do with the play?
Well, I hope he laughs at this, but I think that I'm blessed in having Keegan-Michael Key very interested in the books and the character, because 35 years ago, I think it's 35 years ago, I won't say any more because that would age me incredibly, but 35 years ago, Keegan-Michael Key auditioned for my first play.
So cool. I think that's a great story.
Which was called Back in the World. And it was about African-American Vietnam veterans.
Right. So you were 18 and he was 2.
Yeah. I wish I were 18. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. But he auditioned, and his audition was phenomenal.
Right.
It was just phenomenal. The only problem was he looked like a 16-year-old kid.
Yeah, which he was.
And which, wouldn't pass muster for a African-American Vietnam veteran.
Right.
Still, his audition was mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
So, for anybody that thinks that the universe doesn't have a sense of humor.
Yeah.
Did
you guys stay in touch?
No, we have not.
So you've met since then, right? Since all this, or you've been in touch?
Yeah.
Does he remember that audition?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
No.
Is there a story?
No.
Okay, all right, I can let that go. But so the other thing you talked about was like the whole thing with the pandemic, and we talked about this yesterday. Yeah,
right.
What was pandemic writing like for you? What you know, did you, how did you cope? What did you do? Did it work for you as an introvert because you got to stay home and everything was quiet, or what did you, were you able to write? What happened with you?
Well, in all honesty, Ellen, it was the pandemic has, not unlike a lot of folks out there and viewing this now, it was difficult.
Yeah.
Because quite honestly, I'm not the go out and let's do this, do that type of person. I'm not really an extrovert. I don't.
A lot of writers aren't, I don't think. Yeah.
But the thing that I enjoyed before the pandemic was the fact that I had a choice. Mm-hmm. And whenever my lovely wife, Mary Kate, would say, why don't we go over and visit so-and-so and their family? And my response would be, oh, no. Why? No, I'm not real hot on them. But that choice was taken away from me. It was like, you can't go out. You no longer have a choice. You are staying at home. So that was, having that choice taken away from me was difficult. And as far as writing, I think like a number of writers, like a number of people in general, there was this malaise that settled over me.
Yeah, that's the word you used yesterday when we talked. Yeah. And you also were saying that you wanted to talk a little bit about publishing a book during the pandemic. And I bet Barbara has
something
for you to say about that, but what it's like to have a book come out, because your book was moved. When I interviewed you for the Virginia Book Festival in 2019, Lives Laid Away had come out. And so I kept saying, where's the next one? You know, because Dead of Winter was supposed to come out before, and your publisher, like mine, pushed your books up to 2021. Mm-hmm. 2020 was 2020. And so to talk a little bit about, you know, sort of publishing during a pandemic, and Barbara, you jump on in for this, because it's been a thing.
Crazy thing, primarily because there are a lot of writers out there who had their books published during the pandemic who never got a chance to go out and promote them, to shake hands and answer questions face to face.
Yep,
and science. Meet the people that were reading their books.
Yeah.
And that was a devastating blow for not only for those writers, but for those independent bookstores.
Mm-hmm. How was it for you? How did it feel for you to have your book moved up and everything else? How was that?
Very unsure, very isolating.
Hmm. Were you happy to have it not come out in 2020, or frustrated, or?
Well, you know, it's one of those things of you want your baby to be born.
Of course, yeah.
But it was one of those things of wanting the baby to be born, but wanting the baby to be born in a healthy environment. And there was the hope in those ensuing months between having it pushed back and the May 4th release date of hoping that everyone's environment was improved, that everyone's lot was improved.
Did you have more time to write then because they pushed it back? Do you think that helped you make a better book, or was it done and they just held it, or what was
that? It was difficult. We continued with the editorial process.
Well, that's good. So you had more time.
So I had a little bit more time.
Do you think that made it a better book?
I would have to say yes.
Yeah, I think so too. The more time you get, I do too. The better the writing is, the more you can work with it.
I would agree with that.
Yeah.
Because, and this may be saying the unmentionable, but sometimes a writer may feel the pressure to produce the product.
Yes. It's called a deadline and a contract.
Right. It goes from art to being the product.
To being a business.
To being a business. Right. And there's nothing wrong with business because I was in the business world for 30 years.
Right.
Over 30 years.
Right.
But this is your story. A novel is your story. It's something that you're trying to communicate on a very intimate level. Mm-hmm. And it's sometimes difficult to think of it as a product. That being said, that extra time, I think allowed me to provide a better product.
Your writing is wonderful. Your writing is wonderful. I mean, and one of the things I wanted to ask you about, and I hope we still have some time, but you know, you were a poet and everything else, and I had an interview I found on a blog called Crime Watch, where you said reading poetry was where you began to see, understand, and appreciate the weight, color, scent, and sensation of individual words. And the thing I love so much about your writing is it's just so lyrical. It's just so wonderful. It's so erudite also. It's just a gorgeous, I don't want to read it quickly. And in fact, I still have more of your book to read, and because I don't want to rush. And it's clear that you've really taken time with the words. And so do you think that you're a poet, you're a playwright, and you have a background in advertising. And how much of all of those things infuse your work now, do you think? The poetry, I think, is definitely there.
You know, the poetry stays with me, and I continue to read poetry.
That's obvious, yeah. You can tell.
Anything, you know, Nikki Giovanni, she's got a new book out, new collection out. Seamus Heaney, yep. Who is a wonderful Irish poet.
Right.
You name it. Pablo Neruda, I've read over and over and over. These folks have been my teachers. Mm-hmm. They've been my mentors.
Mm-hmm.
So I love what I've learned about the importance of the right word choice from these wonderful poets.
Yes. What about the playwright? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but about the playwright? You have very vivid scenes, and then last but not least, advertising is about selling a product, and I'm just sold. So talk about those two elements as well. And I didn't mean to mention poetry.
I'll take advertising first. Advertising, marketing, communications taught me how to edit, how to rewrite on the fly.
Okay.
You know, you may invest, you know, 2-3 days in writing the perfect 15-second, 10-second, 30-second TV, radio ad or magazine ad, and take pride in what you did. But ultimately, it's up to the client. And if the client says, "Yeah, it's okay," can you show me something else?
Right.
You can't stand in front of a client who is paying the agency, you know, $15, $20, $30 million a quarter. And you can't stand in front of them and say, "Hey, what's the matter with you? This is art. Get out of here."
Right.
What you do is you go back and you edit and you rewrite and you recreate.
Right.
So
you murder your darlings all the time then.
Exactly.
I think you do that a little bit in journalism, but not as much as in advertising. Because you get a deadline, you know? I mean, it's done, you know? If you miss it, miss the boat, yeah. Right. So what about you have very, and I can never say this word, cinematographic. Your scenes are so, you know, they're great, you know? So is that the playwright in you that sees things in scenes, or what's that?
Well, the playwright in me as far as dialogue comes from essentially something that my father said, God rest his soul, a long time ago. And it was as elegant and eloquent as shut up and listen.
Right.
You'll learn more from listening than flapping your gums.
Right. It's true.
So you listen to people, you listen to the cadence of how they speak. You listen to the words that they're saying, and you listen to the motivation behind the words that they're saying. And even if the words are a true representation of what they're feeling,
right,
what they're thinking. So to my father, you rascal, you, that is what I learned. Shut up and listen.
Right.
Engage folks, but be willing to listen.
Right.
Not judge in the moment. Listen.
Yeah.
So.
I'm keeping an eye on my clock here, but so you said there's going to be another August Snow book, and then there's going to be two more. And then you want to do something different. And first of all, you're going to have a lot of outraged fans, me included, if you don't write more August Snow books. But can you, so where, what are you working on now? What's coming out when, and what's next?
Well, I don't know what's coming out next. I don't know what's happening next, other than I've got, you know, a nice glass and a nice bourbon here. I am working on, and this goes back to the Midwest guy thing of, well, I don't want to talk about it until I've done it.
Right.
But I am working on developing a new August Snow story.
Good. The fourth book.
After that, I'd want to explore two stories that I have notes on, some dialogue on, and a couple of folders on two laptops. I don't trust electronics.
You don't, and you have to talk about Godzilla before we're done. I want to hear about Godzilla. But anyway, finish, and then we'll go back to Godzilla.
Well, you know,
two laptops.
Yeah, I have an idea for a Western and an idea for a standalone crime novel.
Mm-hmm.
The crime novel based in Detroit,
right,
on another neighborhood that's been around for 150 years, 200 years. But just what the generations have come to currently.
Right. Do you know when the next book will be out? Just asking for.
No, I'm afraid I don't. I'm afraid I don't.
Okay.
And I'm not.
Will there only be one? I thought there might be two August Snow books. One for sure.
No, you stop it. You stop it right there, young lady.
All right.
Let me do these things one at a time.
All right. So why do you write with Godzilla?
Well, Godzilla is, you know, he's just a comfort to know. He's.
I can see that. I can see that.
Excuse me, I'm having a discussion here. He gets, you know.
Fancy.
He loves the camera and all of that. But Godzilla to me is keeping a sense of playfulness.
Uh-huh.
And I
he's
think
he's always there.
He's always there. Yeah.
Okay.
Always there.
Okay.
You're just lucky I didn't wear my Godzilla t-shirt tonight, which
what a loss.
There are certain people in this house say it's not dignified for
you
a
look
man.
Very elegant.
Well, dignity is not our hallmark, for heaven's sake. And this reminds me that the last time we saw Stephen was at a conference that we held on the occasion of Ian Rankin's 30th publication, but also for Poison Pen Press and Soho Press as kind of partners. And Stephen was one of the Soho authors that attended. We did this at the Arizona Biltmore before they remodeled. So I'm not sure we're going back to the Arizona Biltmore because I'm not a big fan of the remodeling, but we'll leave that aside. In any case, Stephen absolutely wowed the audience because he's so funny. You were such a funny speaker and so much humor as well as love in what you had to say. And it was really a pleasure. Do you remember Ian's speech that he made that brought us basically all to tears and left Hank Philippi Ryan speechless?
I remember bits of that, Barbara, but I'll tell you what I remember most was the first time I met Ian, and I feel pretentious for saying Ian, but it was at a pre-party, and I was drinking a beer and talking with some other folks, and this gentleman appeared next to me, and the first thing out of his mouth was, "Oh, what I wouldn't do for a beer," and I turned, and it was Ian Rankin. And in all of my eloquence, I said,
yes.
Rankin.
Well, he is a legend, but the truth is he's really one of the most regular guys that I know. I'm extremely fond of Ian. I've known him forever, and I really enjoyed giving the pre-party, but you didn't need to be speechless at all because he's a celebrity that wears his celebrity as though it were, I don't know, he doesn't even notice it.
Right.
You know, one of the things I love about him.
That old saying of never meet your heroes.
Yeah.
That is so untrue in certain cases.
Yes, it is.
He was just a wonderful gentleman and funny. And I also have to say this, meeting another one of my writing heroes, Mr. James Salas.
Oh, that's true, because he did interview Ian, didn't he?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, and that was truly memorable.
At one of the occasions at Poison Pin, he played with his music group, Three Legged Dog.
Oh, wow.
It was really a nice weekend. It was very low key. It wasn't very large. It was, you know, 100 and some people, but it was one of the nicest things we did because you didn't have all that pressure of trying to keep track of, you know, lots of people with different agendas. And it was great to, you know, to celebrate his 30th novel with Ian, a goal for many writers. In any case, let's call Patrick up because he probably has questions or things he wants to say.
All right.
You remember that, Patrick? Mm-hmm. That was a really remarkable weekend.
I sure do.
Your poster, I was thinking of that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just have a question for you, kind of a general question about You know, when I think of Detroit, you know, I think about music, you know, and what a wonderful musical heritage, you know, particularly popular music, of course, the Motown sound. And last year I read a wonderful memoir by Wayne Kramer from the MC5, who a lot of people probably don't know the MC5, but they were a late 60s kind of revolutionary rock and roll band from Detroit. And he, the only reason I bring it up is that he talks so much about the Detroit of his youth, you know, in the 60s and even into the 70s, and what a magical place it was, you know, and so, you know, kind of the death of the city that he once knew, and just about, you know, what a spectacular place it was to grow up. And I love in your books how you allude to the ghost of Detroit past. Do you see glimmers of a renaissance in Detroit, of a movement back into the city, and all those wonderful old buildings, you know, they're there?
There's more than the glimmering of a renaissance. There is a bright light of renaissance. And trust me, it takes me a lot to actually say that about the city, because I've been here for 40 years when it was trying to be known as the Renaissance City. There was nothing Renaissance about it. The truth of the matter is, it is extraordinary. I can't even condos are being built. People are paying extraordinary prices to live in apartments and condos and houses that 3-4 years ago would have sold for $50,000 are now selling for $350,000, $450,000. There are 3- and 4-star Michelin restaurants. It's amazing. It all comes at a price for the people that have lived there for the longest and believed in the city. That being said, you can pitch a handful of pea gravel and hit a great restaurant. You've heard of Shinola, the watchmaker, wallet maker. Jack White has his store downtown. John Vavros, designer, you know, his clothes I could never fit into, but you know, people are paying $300-$400 for a pair of jeans. It's just come alive. People love the night scene. They love the restaurant scene. As far as music goes, yes, when you come here, visit the Motown Museum, you'll be moved to tears. It's extraordinary.
I really like the Detroit airport because I think it has some of the best subway tiles ever. I was so impressed when I went through the Detroit airport. I mean, I have a thing about subway tiles, and it was just like fabulous.
No, you hit on something, Barbara, because those tiles were made by Powabic pottery.
Were they?
And Powabic pottery has been made in Detroit for 125, 150 years.
Oh, great. If they're used in the airport, then that's even nicer to, you know, kind of a souvenir. And I will say, Stephen, you can't expect to eat in Mexican restaurants and wear designer jeans. I mean, it's a choice. You just can't do both. Right. Anything else, Patrick, before we wind up?
Absolutely.
Well, a lot of people are just commenting about what about the dulcet tones of your voice.
Yes.
Have you done radio or at all?
No, I haven't. There are people that wish I had done radio, but I prefer sitting in my overstuffed chair that looks like Jabba the Hutt and writing. Thank you for the compliment, but
your voice is great.
My son.
I used to do a recording for the blind and dyslexic here at a studio in Phoenix, and
they would hear
one sentence for you, and they would just pounce on you and get you in there.
I've done readings for the blind at the Michigan State Library in Lansing.
You should read your own audiobooks.
It's wonderful. But no, I'm more comfortable, you know, sitting in Jabba the Hutt's lap and making stuff up and running ideas past this guy.
Do you have a collection of Godzilla, or are readers giving you Godzillas?
No, they have not been.
This may change.
Address to send them to. That address is no.
Yeah. Care of Soho Press.
I do.
Ellen Crosby, care of.
Oh, no. I love it.
I do have a collection of Godzilla t-shirts. And
I'm going to say that if you don't wear one next time, I am going to send you back to change. I mean, I'm really disappointed we didn't get to see since you won't stand up. We couldn't really get the full effect of it. So maybe you can do a little workout before we see you in public again.
Godzilla onesie.
That'd be great. So, well, many of us are wrestling with pandemic weight gain. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see.
Everybody from the waist down without masks.
Everybody out exercising again because they have to get out of their pajama pants.
Barbara, I have to thank you. And this is not just a spur of the moment thing. I have told my wife and son this a number of times that I owe you such a debt of thanks for when the last time I was out there, you had me paired with a gentleman that I never met before named Joe Ide. And Joe had just released his IQ book, Wrecked. And it was as if we had known each other forever, to the point where after, you know, our stint at Poison Pen, we went to do you remember the pizza shop we went to? And I was trying to be Midwestern nice. And if Joe is watching this, he will call you immediately and say, I'm out of my mind. The truth of the matter is, we sat down and I said, innocently enough, would you want to split a pizza? And Joe looked at me with the look of daggers and said, split a pizza? Why don't you get your own pizza? And it was like, oh, it's on now.
Yes, well, it was an inspired pairing, and timing has a lot to do with when we can do that. And, you know, I'm hoping we're going to actually have, I can announce it now, our first live event on July 6th since the pandemic started. So we're excited about that. And we have William Ken Kruger is going to start his book tour live with us on August 21st, I think the date is, whatever that Monday might happen to be. So we're beginning to see some signs of life. We have to work out our protocols because, you know, businesses are all basically having to make it up since, you know, there's not a lot of guidance. I don't want my staff to be counselors, and we don't. Sorry.
Will you stream it as well? So.
Oh yeah, no, we always did. You know, I mean, that we've been really, you know, the pandemic has barely touched us in that sense, because we were always streaming everything, and it's given us a chance to do a lot of creative things that we couldn't do when it was only possible to broadcast live events. For example, Patrick and the other Pat, you have to be named Patrick in part to work at the Poison Pen, they have discussion clubs, and they've been able to do those online so that people who don't live here can now join in the book discussions that, you know, previously they had to show up at the store for. So yeah. Patrick, are you going to keep your club as an online thing, or are you going to do it as a hybrid with people at the store, but also video?
I don't know. That's a good question. We're going to be talking about that, because we do have a couple of, or at least one, who's out of town now.
Well, we'll figure it out. You know, I think that there's a lot of chances to do interesting things. So,
yeah.
I just want to take this opportunity to thank wonderful.
Yes. Thank you, Ellen, very much.
This is the greatest one.
Angel Sheriff was the last one she published with Minotaur, and now she has done The French Paradox with the new publisher, Severn, and you have another one in the works, don't you, Ellen?
I do. I'm supposed to turn it in any day now. So,
yeah.
Absolutely wonderful reading.
Sweet.
Ellen, I love you. I would say if I did not know you. And of course, I'm obligated to say, hi.
Well, congratulations.
Great book.
Right. Gotcha. Thank you very much for signing our books. We really appreciate it, Stephen. And Ellen, we appreciate your signing our books as well, even though they're all sold out at this point. But it's been wonderful to see you both. So thank you so much. Thank you all for joining us who've been watching the program. Don't forget to order a copy of Stephen's book, From the Poison Pen, an autographed copy, and enjoy the rest of your evening. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.